Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee took action on the K-12 and higher education budgets. Republican legislative leaders quickly gaveled out of the special session Governor Tony Evers called to expand Medicaid and invest much of the resulting one-time funding into local projects. And the Democratic field for U.S. Senate is continuing to grow after a state lawmaker announced his candidacy this week. Rewind, your week in review for May 28th.
I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Republican lawmakers on the Joint Finance Committee this week approved a $128 million increase for K-12 education over the next biennium. Lawmakers voted to send $350 million as well to the state's stabilization fund, funds JFC leaders said could be used for education costs in future years. Governor Tony Evers' budget sought a $1.5 billion increase over the next 2 years. Republicans say they crafted their plan while keeping in mind the $2.4 billion the state's schools are set to receive in federal aid. But in order to get the money approved under the last two COVID relief packages, states have to maintain K-12 spending proportions over the next biennium compared to their average allocation for 2016 through 17 through 2018 and 19. The GOP plan also included $89 million more for special education, $19 million more for mental health services, $12.7 million more for high-cost transportation aid, $6.3 million more in sparsity aid, and more. So much to dig into here at JR. I guess let's start with the co-chair's realization that Wisconsin could lose billions in federal aid for schools unless Wisconsin does maintain its commitment to K-12 funding. This was something that the co-chair said they were made aware of this week. There was a DPI memo to JFC from April 1st that mentioned this very thing, so it's unclear when exactly this realization came about. But, Jared, at any point this week, did you think there was a possibility that voting on the K-12 and higher ed budgets could be postponed in light of this realization?
I definitely thought I could give him pause, but basically kind of the takeaway from Thursday's hearing is Republicans are telling the federal government, well, come and take it. We're going to go ahead with this budget as we want to do it. If you're really that intent on making us stick to these levels, come and take it. So remember, what this guidance says is that it's proportional, right? So roughly 35% of general purpose revenue being spent on K-12 in those 3 years, we have to meet that mark. Now, there's this weird thing about the requirement that it's not just how much you spend on K-12, but also how much you spend on higher ed. You have to meet both of those requirements. We are short on both right now, the way the budget is put together by Republicans. It would be $428 million in additional general purpose revenue as a budget was crafted through yesterday to meet that mark. We had $128 million into K-12 and $23 million into higher ed total.
Yep.
We're well short of that mark. Mm-hmm. The $350 million does not count toward the education spending because it doesn't really count toward education, period. It's going to stabilization fund, go to anything. So they're basically saying, okay, federal government, we think the guidance is going to change. We think as states try and live up to your standards, you're going to realize that this is not a livable standard, and you're going to change your mind. In the meantime, if you really want to come in and tell Milwaukee Public Schools they can't have $800 million you promised them, you go ahead and do that. And I think it's where they're at. I mean, and the Republican point is that there's so much federal money flowing into schools that it's like a budget on top of a budget. I mean, usually you're talking like an increase of a couple hundred bucks per kid in each aid each year. We're talking thousands of dollars for some schools, especially Milwaukee Public Schools, over the next 3 years. It's $11,000 per kid over a three-year period. That is a huge increase, a chance to be transformational for Milwaukee Public Schools. And Republicans are arguing you cannot consider the budget in a vacuum. You have to take into consideration that federal money because it's unrealistic not to.
Right. Let's talk more about that $350 million they set aside in this fund for, they say, future K-12 uses. They also stipulated that it wouldn't be used in the coming biennium, but could be used in future years after that. But of course, a future legislature could decide to do whatever they want with that money. Mm-hmm. Have you seen something like this, the bulk of a K-12 funding increase being directed to a stabilization fund before?
No, and that's why, I've never seen lawmakers make a provision in the budget to move money to the stabilization fund, period. What typically happens is that there's a law passed some years ago that anytime we have more revenue growth than what we expected, a percentage of it goes in the stabilization fund. It's grown. It was going to be nearly $1 billion by the end of this fiscal year. It's not going to quite hit that mark because the tax cut that was signed in February, but it's still going to be a healthy balance. But that money goes there automatically when there's revenue growth beyond the expectations. We don't see budget provisions that say, take this money and put it aside in the stabilization fund. Also, I'm looking forward to seeing the language of how they're going to do this because Governor Evers can veto things with partial veto authority. Here's the catch, though. I don't know if he can redirect that money to something else. Again, the language is very important, how it's put in there. So if he vetoes it going to the stabilization fund, it just sits in the general fund and is sitting there. And Republicans, quite frankly, don't have any qualms about leaving money in the general fund because they think in 2022 it could be a good year for them. And if they win the governor's office and there's a big pot of money sitting in the general fund, in 2023, you can see a scenario in which Republicans pass some kind of like tax cut or tax rebate to kick off Republican Governor X's first month or two of his or her term. So they're kind of like, yeah, that money is there. If you veto it, fine. It sits in the general fund. We're not going to spend it.
Yeah, and for comparison's sake, when we're looking at the last budget and what the Joint Finance Committee did on K-12, it was around a $500 million mm-hmm. increase that they proposed. I guess already at this point, you know, a day after these votes, we're already sort of hearing rumors flying that Evers is going to veto the budget based on this $128 million proposed increase. What do you make of those rumors at this point? And also, do you think there is a chance later on in the budget that lawmakers could revisit K-12, reopen it, and maybe consider making some adjustments?
There's always a chance, but I don't know that they want to reopen it because the vibe that I've been getting is that Republicans are trying to put – see, most budgets I've covered, K-12 waits till the end because lawmakers are trying to figure out how much money they have left from everything else to squeeze as much as possible into K-12 and a little bit into UW sometimes. My impression this time is they're trying to see how much money they have left over to squeeze into Medicaid to help nursing homes and then to a tax cut. So it's a different kind of vibe with this, in part because of that federal money coming in. Now, the governor might veto the budget basically going on since before he basically introduced it. Here's the problem for Evers. If he vetoes the budget, they're not going to do another one. There are some Republicans I've talked to who are totally content to say, you have that federal money, Governor Evers, you spend it on basically operating state government. Because they're happy, they think there's just too much money coming in, there's enough money for schools with what's happening with the federal government that they don't do anything. Now, there's a catch there. A lot of rural schools are not getting big paydays, if you want to call it that, from the feds. Because the formula is based off of, for the bulk of money, is based off of poverty. Milwaukee is getting a lot of money. Milwaukee also has a lot of poverty. It is not really a prize you want to win when it comes to something like this. But their Republican districts in rural areas, small towns, they're not getting as much money from the federal government. If they don't do anything, they're not getting it. Now, they did do this pot of ESSER money, which helps. So separate from this Title I formula, there's a pot of money that was a DPI wanted to use to do minimum grants, right? So $600,000. Of all these Title I program funds, if you didn't get $600,000, you would get a minimum grant up to that. Well, now Republicans have reworked that pot of money to work out to $781 per student if you qualify for it. It prioritizes in-person education at least half time this past school year. Those are mostly their districts because your Milwaukee's, your Green Bay's, your Madison's, they weren't going to meet that standard. So that kind of takes care of that issue with their districts, right? So, but with the governor, if he vetoes it, what does he get in return? I mean, Medicaid's a red line for him. They're not going to expand Medicaid, so that would be enough for him to veto it. But what's he get in return for vetoing the budget? And that's a challenge. How's this thing play out? What's it look like in the end? And is he satisfied that also, we don't know how he can work with the partial veto authority. Maybe he can make it at least palatable for himself. But there is definitely a question, what's the upside for Governor Evers with no budget? Because I don't think they're going to do another one for him if he vetoes this one.
Yeah, and I'm glad you brought up the ESSER money from the latest ARPA COVID relief package, because that's one thing that the committee acted on and we haven't talked about yet. It is worth noting, and I think you did stress this, but just for folks at home, 90% of the money that's funneled to the state goes through the Title I formula. Mm-hmm. So really, we only have purview, and there's still pretty strong guardrails over the remaining 10%. And this action this week to sort of prioritize in-person education is sort of builds off action that the committee took in February to do a similar thing with the second pot of ESSER money, ESSER II funding, right? Yep.
Yeah. What's also interesting is there's the third pot of money. All right. There's $1.5 billion in that pot alone. $1.4 billion almost, like, is 1.386 to be really accurate, goes to the Title I formula, which is just basically, you know, poverty. Of that remaining money, there are earmarks for learning loss, summer school programs, after school programs. When I first looked at that package a while ago, I asked, can Republicans play with these earmarks for those three things? Because there's also a pot of money in there that DPI wanted to put toward these minimum grants and the administrative costs. Those three earmarks, it wasn't quite clear to me if they could, I'm not a lawyer, if they could play with that. Well, they did. They grabbed $77 million that was supposed to be for learning loss and put it into this emphasis toward in-person learning. The other two pots of money, they added a requirement that small rural districts get first crack at it, essentially. They are prioritizing their schools and their districts for that money. Now, the argument is it's leveling the playing field, right? If you've got Milwaukee getting $11,000 per kid, essentially, over these three packages, how can you say no to doing this? But yeah, it's going to be interesting in this education money. There's just a lot of it. I mean, there is a lot of it. And so it kind of shades the entire debate about the budget, because it used to be K-12 was like the centerpiece. Now it's not in this budget. For the first time in my years covering the budget, it's not really a centerpiece of what's going on with GPR spending.
Yeah, let's hear more from Representative Mark Boren, the co-chair of the Joint Finance Committee, and Senator John Erpenbach about this entire K-12 debate.
Our average school district in Wisconsin will receive $2,898 per pupil from federal ESSER funds alone. This is over 10 times larger than the largest annual per pupil adjustment since 1993. As we continue to receive billions in federal funds for K-12 education, we will set aside $350 million in education funding for ongoing costs in the future. This will help maintain funding stability for future K-12 budgets.
Obviously, if we are going to be accepting the federal money, we need to maintain an effort of at least 35% funding moving forward. Otherwise, the feds will come knocking on the door and take that money back. Now, the $500 million that they're proposing, from what I understand, $350 that is going to go into the Republican slush fund on finance that DPI will have to come back on bended knee and beg for. I don't think that's going to help toward the maintenance of effort of 35% that we need to maintain throughout this process.
The Joint Finance Committee this week also voted to lift the tuition freeze for UW System schools. The 11-4 vote gives the Board of Regents, now controlled by Governor Tony Evers' appointees, the authority to raise tuition on in-state undergraduate students. It's worth noting that the freeze has been in place since 2013. Evers' budget had called for continuing the freeze for the next 2 years, but backfilling it with general purpose revenue. Lawmakers also voted to approve an $8.5 million GPR increase for UW System, though that money is headed towards a supplemental appropriation, meaning UW will have to come back and ask for permission to spend it. The big thing with the end of the freeze, though, JR, is there's no guardrails, right? There's no ties to inflation, no policy surrounding it whatsoever. What I've heard is two things on this, right? A continuation of GOP lawmakers' efforts to put as little policy language in the budget as possible. And also, it's Evers' Board of Regents now. If they go off the rails, assuming this budget is approved as written, if they go off the rails and raise tuition by, you know, more than inflation, right? That's on them. It's not on lawmakers. But that said, lawmakers did say that, you know, if there is a decision to jack up tuition, they would sort of be the guardians of that. There's a potential that they could introduce bills to try to put those guardrails on it, but in standalone legislation and not in the budget. What do you make of all of those comments?
So a couple of things. One, the bill working through right now from Senator Roth and Representative Murphy as a consumer price index as a cap for tuition. That's not in the budget. Therefore, there's the governor, you have to get the governor to sign it to put it in place. I'm not sure Governor Evers would sign that bill. I haven't asked him about it yet, but if you think about it, that's not something that Democrats really favored. They argue for control by the Board of Regents in this issue. Two, Republicans have known for several years at some point the freeze has to go away. It's just a matter of when and who's going to be the one to bite the bullet. And actually, they just didn't put it back into the budget. Because remember, when they took the budget to base, current law says a freeze ends at the end of the 2021 school year. There's no more freeze in current law. So they just didn't put it back in. Now, there's another subtext to all this. Several of Governor Evers' appointees to Board of Regents have not been confirmed. So in theory, or theory that I heard, you could see Senator Roger Roth, who chairs the Universities Committee, hanging that over the heads of these appointees of like, oh, you guys raised tuition 10%. This is a problem for you when it comes to you getting confirmed by the state Senate. I'm not saying he's going to do that, but there's a theory that he could. Also, remember we talked about the Board of Regents president election in June? They also aren't confirmed about that. We talked about that before. So there's that issue hanging out there. What's also interesting is they're not giving much, if anything, to the university system. And what they're saying is, okay, Governor Evers, if you want to fund these guys, reverse the lapse. So remember, anticipation of a possible problem with state revenues because of the pandemic, agencies across the board had to lapse money. Basically a cut. You send money back to the general fund. It's $86 million University of Wisconsin system. We were projected at one point to have a $1.85 billion surplus end of this fiscal year. Now that's dialed back a little bit because of that tax cut. We will get new revenue estimates sometime in the next week or two that can give us a better idea where we're at. But they're saying, okay, Governor, if you want to fund the university, just restore the lapse. Just give the money back to them. You've got the cash. It's right there in the general fund. We'll see if he does that. Also worth noting that former Governor Tommy Thompson, a Republican, the reason why he was, you know, looked at as somebody who could really work with Republican lawmakers is he's one of them, right? The freeze is going away, but there's no big boost for UW. So how does this reflect on Thompson and his leadership at UW? Now, the flip side of that question is, and when you can't prove, is would somebody else have done better, right? Because Tommy has connections with a lot of these guys. Now, granted, almost none of the Republicans anymore on the Capitol served with Tommy Thompson as governor. But if it was a President Lyle or President Riley or President Cross, would they have gotten a better deal out of the board, out of the Joint Finance Committee than what Tommy Thompson did? I don't know, and you can never prove it, right? But anyway, so that's all that's kind of hanging out there. Again, there's also federal money, though, going to the University of Wisconsin system, so that helps. So there's not like there's no money, but the debate about that federal money, it's interesting because to Democrats, it's not money to backfill or to replace state funds. It's an add-on. To Republicans, it is basically a complement to state funding. So they're going to keep state funding kind of flat for a lot of things and say, okay, that federal money is part of the equation. It's not an separate from state funds. It is part of the mix.
Going back to Tommy Thompson and his role in all of this, I just recall in January he told reporters that he didn't sense a tuition freeze was coming and he wasn't pushing for it because he didn't think there was an appetite among GOP lawmakers. So it's also interesting to look at how much has changed in the last 5 months and how on the ball Thompson was with sort of the appetite of the legislature as it evolved in that period. So I think that's worth keeping an eye on, too. The other thing I wanted to mention is when looking at the sort of the GPR increases for, you know, the Higher Education Aids Board for UW system and for the Tech College system, Tech College is getting $9 million total over the biennium, which is slightly higher than the $8.5 million that the UW system is getting. And then, of course, the $5 million that HEAB is getting. Interesting to see the Tech College system outpacing, you know, in a way.
Remember, UW can raise tuition, right? Mm-hmm. So can Tech College. Tech colleges can also raise property taxes. So I'm watching the rest of this debate going forward is what are they going to do on property taxes? Because now there's a thing with K-12 education before that's called the revenue limit. So it's the limit on how much you can spend on kids between property taxes and state aid. The more aid is flat, the more you can raise in property taxes. Now, it'll be a while before we see everything, how it shakes out. But what I'm watching is are there future property tax caps put into this budget to try and keep a lid on that stuff? I don't know where that discussion goes. I haven't dived into it yet, so maybe I'll find out some more if I actually ask a question about it. But it kind of struck me yesterday, like, okay, I don't see anything on per pupil limits. Maybe there's something I missed, but I'm wondering what happens going forward about those that property tax issue.
Yeah, there's so much more we could dive into with K-12, but let's move on to Medicaid expansion. Lawmakers quickly gaveled out of Governor Tony Evers' special session call to expand Medicaid. Evers last week called the session and announced $850 million in projects that would be covered by the extra $1 billion in one-time funds the expansion would bring. That includes $200 million to expand broadband, $100 million toward replacing lead pipes, $100 million for local roads and bridges, and more. Evers told reporters this week, quote, "This shouldn't be about politics or ideology. It should be about doing what's best for our state and, frankly, when Wisconsin needs it the most." GOP legislative leaders responded in yet another letter, quote, "Expanding Medicaid as you have proposed is unneeded and even reckless in a state that has no coverage gap and has an effective reinsurance plan." No surprises here politically. I've frankly lost count of the number of special session calls Evers has made and Republicans have gaveled in and gaveled out of. But JR, do you see a time in the future, maybe in some alternative universe, where lawmakers here in Wisconsin would approve the federal Medicaid expansion?
Well, going to this budget, the question was, would it ever get too expensive to turn down? And there's additional federal money that frees up state money to pay for the expansion. They've passed up on that now for 8 straight years. Now we have a $1 billion sweetener in this budget, they pass on that again. So apparently that's not too expensive yet for them. So the only thing that I've kind of wondered about is if Robin Voss is not speaker any longer in the assembly, maybe he is a leading opponent to Medicaid expansion. And he's laid out the reasons why. There's no coverage gap in Wisconsin. The people who be moved into Medicaid can get coverage in the exchanges right now. The difference in exchanges and Medicaid are subtle. But out-of-pocket expenses are not dramatically different. Now, you're also talking about people who are making like less than $18,000 a year, so every bit kind of counts. But there's not a big difference in coverage. Also, you were talking about taking people, of the 91,000 who go on to Medicaid, about half right now already have coverage through the exchanges. Some people who are on coverage through their employer might be moved on. I mean, there are all these reasons that he says it's not a problem or an issue. But he's a leading opponent to doing it. So maybe if he were not speaker anymore, it would change, but he has definitely led the charge against Medicaid expansion, and Republicans have been unified in their opposition. You don't hear many Republicans saying, "I'm open to this," right? I mean, in years past, maybe one or two would say, "Okay, maybe we should think about it." You're not hearing any like dissenting voices publicly talking about taking Medicaid expansion among the Republicans that I've talked to, Republican lawmakers.
Yep, that's right. Another issue that Governor Evers will likely continue to hit on, though, for the remainder of his first term in office. Let's move on now to our fourth topic. Lots of committee hearings this week, JR. Legislators held hearings on abortion, transgender bills, and a host of other pieces of legislation. In a series of lengthy committee meetings this week, lawmakers heard testimony on bills surrounding abortion, criminal justice, transgender athletes, and so much more. The two abortion measures are similar to bills introduced in the past that failed to clear the legislature. One, for example, that got a lot of attention would bar UW employees from performing or assisting with abortions as part of their work. UW fears a loss of accreditation for their OBGYN residency program if that were to pass. Meanwhile, 7 policing bills recommended by the Racial Disparities Task Force all received public hearings, while a bill to broaden expungement eligibility cleared a committee. And the final 2 bills to prevent transgender student athletes from participating in girls' or women's sports from elementary school through college got those committee hearings, and, you know, if they do get to the floor and pass, are headed for a likely Evers veto. Meanwhile, in, I guess, committee inaction this week, the Senate and Assembly Elections Committees canceled previously scheduled hearings, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss confirmed he is hiring retired police officers to investigate the November 2020 election. So there's a ton of stuff going on, JR. Let's go back to the elections bills, right? So the Senate committee had planned to exec on 5 bills this week. That includes proposed changes to absentee ballot procedures. Now that's happening via paper ballot. The deadline is later on Friday. But it comes after this sort of a public tiff between Senator Steve Noss and Kathy Bernier, the committee chair, over those bills earlier this spring. Is this just a furthering of that conflict there, or what do you expect to see in terms of that going forward?
Question. There are two of the 5 bills I know that Bernier has an issue with. Burns, a former county clerk. She has issues with these bills. The ballots are due at 3 p.m. today. The question is, will she vote for them? even if it's a negative vote out of committee, the bills can still go to the floor. Then it becomes a question of, can they work out some kind of compromise that makes her happy before final passage, or do they try and pass them without her support? Doesn't matter, honestly, what they do, they're going to get vetoed. Governor Evers is not going to allow any of these bills to become law. It's also going to be part of the Democratic call, rallying cry for 2022 about, if you don't reelect Governor Evers' base, these bills will become law, so let's get motivated. So yeah, so those, that's what I'm watching right now. Does Bernier vote for all five bills? And then if she doesn't, are there any changes made before they go to the floor? Because the GOP base is demanding that the Republicans take action on these things. It's just a question of, you know, Bernier support or non-support for those bills right now.
Right. And let's hear more about the transgender athlete bills from the committee hearings this week. Two individuals who testified about the bills will speak to them in this next video.
Title IX remains the only law that grants women any kind of sports equality in America, and it deserves to be protected. If men are allowed to compete against women, eventually there will no longer be women's sports. There will be men's sports and co-ed sports. By allowing men to participate in women's sports, it robs us of opportunities. There's nothing equal or equitable about oppressing women in their own sports. Why would girls want to participate in sports when they know they are going to get beat by a boy? The message to girls is, you deserve equal opportunities, except in sports. I want to make something very clear with these bills. No one is denying anyone the right to compete in sports. We are fighting to keep men and women competing in their biological sex categories. This is not an emotional issue. This isn't about being anti-transgender. It's not that I and others do not see transgender children as human. It's simply a matter of biological fairness. Anything else is irresponsible and unethical to biological girls and women.
Athletic success is based on many disparate factors that vary from sport to sport, and being trans does not give girls who are trans an inherent advantage over girls who are not. As a result, this bill was premised on incorrect bias and discriminatory myths about trans people that have no place in our state's laws. The intent of these bills is not to protect students in sports, but to alienate trans students and discriminate against them based on their identity. To quote Chief Justice Warren in his majority opinion for Brown v. Board of Education, to separate them from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely to ever be undone. Here, race is not the issue, although it is. Gender identity is as well. Still, the point stands, separating children from their peers on arbitrary notions such as these can have long-lasting effects. This is a bill that tries to solve a problem where none exists.
The Democratic field for U.S. Senate is continuing to grow. State Senator Chris Larson of Milwaukee officially announced his campaign this week. The former unsuccessful candidate from Milwaukee exec would have to give up his state Senate seat if he stays in the race. Already we've heard from State Representative Chris Sinicki, who indicated in a Facebook post she may consider a bid for the seat if Larson doesn't seek re-election. Meanwhile, Stephen Olicara, who co-founded the Millennial Action Project, said he's forming an exploratory committee to look at a potential bid. And four other Democratic candidates are already in the field. Wausau radiologist Julian Bettino, Sarah Godlewski, the state treasurer, ex-Milwaukee Bucks executive Alex Lazary, and Tom Nelson, the Outagamie County exec. The candidates will all be speaking during the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's virtual convention next weekend, according to a preliminary schedule. Jared, the last time we talked about the U.S. Senate field, we discussed the candidates in terms of which lanes they occupy. Which lane do you see Larson in now that he's in the field? And if Olicara does get in, which lane would he be in?
Well, they're both Milwaukee candidates, so it splits the Milwaukee field more. And oh, by the way, the kind of the $64,000 question is, does Mandela Barnes get in? If Mandela gets in, there's one more Milwaukee person in the race. Now, Mandela's an interesting candidate if he gets in because he's from Milwaukee, but he has deep ties to the groups in Dane County that tend to fund campaigns and the activist base. So he's kind of a Madison candidate and a Milwaukee candidate. But the more people in Milwaukee you have running, I heard a theory this week, the better it's for Sarah Godlewski because it splits that Milwaukee vote up a little bit. Now, Tom Nelson also would benefit him, you'd think, because he's an outstate candidate, but there are only so many outstate votes in a Democratic primary. In your typical statewide primary in Wisconsin for Democrats, 40 to 45% of the vote comes from three counties, Milwaukee, Dane, and Waukesha. I know nobody ever guesses Waukesha, but there's a lot of people who live there, including a lot of Democrats. If you don't have tapped into those bases, you have a hard time winning a statewide primary. So Godlewski, if she can capture the Madison crowd, she's in pretty good shape. Nelson can maybe do some outstate damage. We'll see if Galuski has a pull outstate as well. And you know, you can't deny that Lazary or Larson or anybody else can make inroads outstate. But we think about where they're from. They're from Milwaukee. They've got a Milwaukee-based campaign. That's going to be a really tight race for those Milwaukee votes in this campaign.
That's right, and that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks so much for joining me, JR, and thanks for everyone who tuned in. I'm Brianna Riley.
And I'm JR Ross.
And that's Rewind, your week in review for May 28th.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.